Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Grey Milk and Lean's Patreon channel. I am so happy to be joined by my, I can't call you a dear friend yet, but I want to be your friend. My dear friend, wishful thinking, Sarah Gailey, is here with me today. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, it is such a pleasure to be here. And you, as far as I'm concerned, can call and consider me a dear friend.
Excellent. Once we hang out in real life, we're going to like get shots and then we'll be like real friends forever. It'll be great.
Perfect.
Sarah Gailey has been on my show a couple of times. They are a prominent and up and coming and successful, incredible writer. Currently working on White Widow, which I just read right before. The White Widow versus Bad Girls fight is my favorite, but I am loving her likes and dislikes, her like seeking to like find place. It's a wonderful thing to see new takes on characters and to just give them these individual voices. You're just phenomenal, and I'm so glad I know you. Tell everybody a little bit about you and what you might be working on.
Yeah, so I honestly don't feel like I can say things about myself that can follow up that incredible introduction. I'm a writer of prose and comics across lengths and forms. And as you mentioned, Chad, I've been recently having the absolute thrill and incredible honor of seeing the issues come out from my first solo Marvel run, which is a 4-issue mini bringing White Widow into her own characterdom, having just such a blast with that character and giving her kind of a really fun and kind of lighter entree into her own world has been absolutely wild. I've been working with artist Alessandro Miracolo on that one. Colorist Matt Mia has been knocking it out of the park. And then of course, veteran letterer Travis Lanham has been doing some amazing things with the very complicated letters that I gave him. He's been really crushing it.
Yeah, you've got lots of like lists in your stuff, mm-hmm. like lots of background lists. It's good. You've done a really good job.
I love a background gag. And sometimes I will get the joy of working with artists and letterers who also love background gags. And I count myself very lucky in those moments because they don't hunt me down as a result of what I put in the script.
I haven't met Travis. I would love to. Ariana Mar is my favorite letterer. We've connected on the show a few times, and I know how much they love a list as well. You're also doing Know Your Station with Leanna Kangas. How is that going? How's that being received?
It has been received wonderfully. So we had the trade come out this last year, and I mean, the audience response has been phenomenal. Honestly, everyone at Boom has been incredibly supportive, but the readers have been passionate and fun and loud. And again, spotting all the background gags, which is such a pleasure to me. Every time I get a DM that's like, wait a minute, how many times does this toucan show up? I feel like I've done something right.
Oh my goodness. This is an early announcement for the Patreon listeners. We are having Sarah, as well as Liana, as well as Marvel editor Alana Smith all on for an episode in a few weeks. I'm so excited. I have Know Your Station here, but I'm waiting to read it until the week before we record so that when we record my reactions and my praise will be current and live. I'm very excited to read it, and I'm very excited to meet both Alana and Liana. All the us, Sarah, Liana. Now, Sarah and I initially connected because I loved their Marvel Pride story, Black Cat, heisting Kandra. We got to talk a little bit about that on my main show, and then we had a conversation about talking about Kandra, and here we are to talk about Kandra. What do you we kind of talked about this on the main show, but what are your thoughts about why you chose Kandra as the foil for slash love interest for Black Cat in your story?
I mean, Kendra is a perfect fit, right? Black Cat is a thieves' thief. She is like, she steals because she loves theft, because the art of the theft matters to her. And Kendra is a kind of hypercosmic embodiment of guile, who is the patron of the Thieves Guild, who is the kind of queen of formal theft in the Marvel Universe. She's like, she has an interest in every thief's activity. And so they go together really naturally. And of course, in this Marvel Pride short, I wanted to highlight Black Cat's queerness, and having her pursue a woman is one way to go about doing that. And Kandra is like the woman. She is tall, she is legs, she is huge, she is aloof and elegant and violent and scary. And I'm like, my little heart goes pitter-pat.
Except when they make her like a weird little girl in like red queen armor.
Yeah, somebody was reading, I think, a little bit of Anne Rice and got excited to bring the vibe into this comic. But honestly, even when she's the little girl in red armor, the art doesn't really bring child to the forefront of that. The art is like, oh, she's smaller, I don't know.
It brings evil child playing dress up. Kandra is an interesting character. She's a relatively new character. She's a relatively niche character in that she's only connected to a couple of even X-Men characters. She's kind of a, I mean, she's a character people know. I think people are fond of. People easily associate her with Gambit primarily because of her connection to the Thieves and Assassins Guilds. This conversation could take so many directions just based off of that alone. But she's an interesting character. She is the temptress. She is the power behind the scenes. She is the goddess. She is the benefactress. I love you describing her as the embodiment of guile to begin. That's an excellent place to start the conversation. Guile, not the Mortal Kombat character, but how would you define guile for our listeners?
Oh, I think it's a kind of malicious trickery. I think that guile, trickery and trickiness can have a fun connotation. Loki often brings that vibe of like, oh, we're just playing around. Even if that means that you end up dying and your whole family dies, we're goofing. But
When you're immortal, it doesn't matter. I don't care about your family.
yeah, what's the problem? Chill out about it. But guile, I think, has to bring a little bit of malevolence to it.
Yeah, there's a cunning behind all of it as well. What was your initial introduction to Kandra, if you recall?
It was in my preparation for writing Black Cat. I was seeking out a character who would be the perfect object of lust and desire for Felicia. And I was like, okay, well, I know that she's going to be pulling off a heist at the Thieves Guild. And I was researching the Thieves Guild and looking at like the history of the Thieves Guild and looking at the structure, like what is she going to be stealing? What is she going to be taking? And I found, of course, Kandra being the kind of creator of the Thieves and Assassins Guild. And I was like, Kandra, let me learn more about Kandra. And the moment I saw the art, I was like, well, okay, that's her. It's gotta be. And I mean, from there, I just had it reinforced with every turn of the page that she was the perfect woman for this.
On my show, I have learned comic book analytical skills and cultural analytical skills through hundreds of hours of analyzing comic books. And I've been so focused on the Silver Age primarily. It's always a treat for me to take a character like this on these channels and analyze a character from my childhood, because I wasn't around in the Silver Age, but I was definitely reading comics in the 90s. And I'm not sure I knew what I was reading. I just was enjoying it from my 12 or 15 or 22-year-old lens. But looking back and seeing what's happening culturally, I'm a big fan of the Wheel of Time books. I'm not sure if you are a consumer of the books or the show. Are you?
I am, of course, very familiar as they're in my genre of writing, but please do tell me everything that you think about them because I always love hearing new
Oh,
perspectives.
that would be a much, much longer podcast. These are beloved to me. The Wheel of Time in fiction is what like the X-Men are to me in comics, if I'm honest. I love it that much. I read the books multiple times. They're all like 1400 pages long, and there's like 20 of them. You know what I mean? There's an ancient evil that is like influencing certain quote unquote high lords. They're called the Forsaken. And there's this group of kind of the evil immortals. And one of the things I love about the Wheel of Time so much is it makes this really complicated world with shifting cultures and customs. And these characters who would come across as one note in a lot of other series, each one of the Forsaken come across as like very individual. They've got individual power sets, individual motivations. And that's kind of how the externals come across to me in the X-Men world. In the 90s, there was this kind of push toward you got to look at the externals. These are the really scary bad guys that have been around for hundreds of years influencing things. And before they really made their appearance, the only two we really knew about, excuse me, were Celine, who is incredible, and Apocalypse, who is incredible. And then they are connected to this kind of group of all new early 90s characters. I don't know if you know Celine, but you would love her.
She sounds like my type. What can I say?
She's an immortal vampire woman who delights in draining life from humans and like making them worship her.
See, and I just think I could change her.
She wears tight leather corsets, and she's fantastic. She's getting a lot of attention in Kieran Gillen's Immortal X-Men right now, which is fun. She's a transcendently delightful villain. Kandra is the younger, blonder, selfisher version of Celine. And we've never really seen them interact much, but boy, would these two not get along. And they are the only women in a group of characters that are primarily lesser known. The other externals are Cruel, Nicodemus, Gideon, who's relatively well known, Saul, and Absalom, if I'm getting them all right. Some of these characters are being used right now in the new X-Men Unlimited Infinity comics that Steve Orlando and Steve Fox are putting out. We just saw Cruel show up there. So maybe we'll get some Kandra there. We'll see what happens.
One hopes.
What are your preliminary thoughts on the externals or the High Lords themselves?
You know, I have to tell you, as a concept on paper, they're not my type of villain. I don't usually love a shady group that's controlling things from behind the scenes in society, both because obviously there's a lot of like connection to anti-Semitic tropes and beliefs in that kind of structure of villain, and then also
There.
because I'm a monster of the week kind of person. I really don't go in for the big overarching conspiracy theory type plots. So when I think about the concept of the externals, I'm like, ah, this doesn't sound like my jam. And then when I read them on the page, they're my favorite thing because they are so camp. They are like doing everything to level 1000 all the time. And that's what I love best in a villain. I mean, frankly, in any character, but especially in a villain, if you're going to be bad, why not be big too?
There's all these villains at Marvel. God, I could name two dozen off the top of my head who are like these immortal behind the scenes manipulators, right? My problem with the externals is they've never had a lot of room to breathe. Nicodemus, Saul, and Absalom in particular are characters that I think have some pretty significant potential. Burke is the other one I didn't list. There's a guy named Burke too. They all have kind of odd powers. Mutants sometimes are born with what they call kind of like mutant circuit abilities. there's a team from the 70s called Team America. They're all motorcycle riders, and they're all like low-level psychic mutants. And when they combine their powers, they can generate a guy named the Masked Marauder who will fight crime for them. It's very Power Rangers forming the giant Power Ranger, you know. The externals are kind of that way. I'm going to read some words from Teenie Howard from Excalibur Volume 4, Number 12, that kind of sum up what they are. Teenie, we love you if you're listening. At times believed to be a subspecies or evolved offshoot of mutantdom, it is now believed that the so-called High Lords were perhaps an early tendency toward the eventual gifts that mutant kind would come to possess during the Pax Krakoa. Much has been supposed of their origin, limitations, and abilities, but it largely remains in the realm of theory. What is not theoretical is their long-term involvement in human politics, finance, and law. They have oft been seen as a sort of mutant Illuminati. In addition to the abilities of very old, powerful mutants, their additional external gifts included, one, resurrection. The High Lords of Mutantdom can be killed, but most possess rapid healing traits, and all return, occasionally in a different form, if they meet true death. Mutants suspected to have external traits have indeed been tested with death, returning at times several years later. Two, communion. High Lords are always aware of one another, can communicate across great distances, and can come together at will. They are known to possess a shared life force. When one external kills another, their ancient energy is dispersed within the remaining externals. Additionally, their life force can be contained within a gem, which has been shown to keep it out of their shared energetic loop. So Kandra basically has two stories, and we're going to talk about her powers. She's an insanely powerful telekinetic, but she either gets the thief benefactor storyline, or she gets the, look, all the externals are on the page at the same time storyline. And those are kind of the two stories. We're going to spend more time on her fun thiefy stuff and less time on her crazy external stuff. But I'd love to hear some of your thoughts about her connection to this group.
Oh, I think it's fascinating. I mean, I love the dynamic in, I feel like, most types of groups of this nature, where it's like, we're all very powerful. We're all kind of immortal and interconnected. Always ends up being a like very close-knit sibling dynamic, but again maintaining the kind of soapy sexiness of especially the 90s X-Men.
I think it's almost it's like the evil 12 apostles.
Yes, absolutely. Toxic polycule. You know, they're just like, everybody has drama with everybody. Everybody is trying to form like alliances with everybody, and to them the stakes are always both incredibly high and incredibly low. Like, we'll always come back to life. What are you even going to do to us? But also, how dare you steal the vial between my boobs? I'll kill your whole family. And I love
it's very like, I haven't seen you in 300 years, Celine. What are you doing? Like, there's that kind of vibe between them. Their power comes from their ability to stay in the shadows or like form their own circles of power. You know, it's an interesting vibe. And again, for those that know Wheel of Time, that's what I'm talking about with the Forsaken, with these guys. The externals themselves, we're not going to spend a lot of time exploring, but Kandra's relevance to this group is primarily related to what was just referenced in, she has like done this thing where she channels her life force into like a gem. So if she dies, she'll come back. But if you get the gem, you can control her. And the other externals later realize that she has removed this from the gem so that if she dies, her energy does not dissipate into the other externals. And this was a recent storyline that Teenie Howard really emphasized in Excalibur, when Apocalypse is casting a bunch of spells and trying to open like an external mutant gateway, and all their bones get turned into this like gateway monster. It's a whole thing. But Kandra's primary relevance to this group, I think, has been, you know, she's one of the younger members in that the others are hundreds of years older, and she has discovered this secret about like this gem. So a lot of her stories are about the big red gem that contains like her immortal life force.
Allows you to try and get a date with her.
There's like also like a realm within the gem, kind of the way we see it sometimes, like in your story, like Black Cat enters the realm, and inside Kendra's like, this is my throne, what are you? Yeah, you know, it's cute. In X-Force 37, we have a brief belief that Cannonball might have been an external. Turns out that's been retconned. That's not a story relevant for today. But there's a speech from Gideon, who's a character I would also love to cover sometime. He goes, he's talking about all the different externals. Nicodemus brings wisdom. Burke brings fortitude. Saul brings patience. Cruel brings ferocity. Absalom brings despair. Kandra brings guile. And Selene brings corruption. And then he posits, you, Cannonball, you bring opportunity. It's an interesting little way of viewing things, but that word guile in association with her is quite delightful.
Well, and I love that the only two female coded externals are the ones with the worst traits. He's like, all the rest of us bring cool chill vibes and Bud Lights to the party, and those two, they,
I mean, I'd rather have
down.
Guile than despair.
That's fair.
But yeah, no one ever accused Gideon of being a feminist, I don't think.
Yeah, he's not pro-girl boss.
Now we love a thief. Every role-playing game has a thief. Every Dungeons and Dragons crew needs a thief. The X-Men's thief is Gambit. You love yourself some Black Cat. They both give major thief energy. Domino has a little bit of this energy. What's your connection to the character Gambit?
Oh gosh, I mean, Gambit is kind of in the water for my specific like slice of both comics fandom and of like television cartoon fandom. I think that half of the women who I've dated have been trying to look like Gambit. And of course I love a thief. I love a slightly tortured thief who still has a great sense of humor. He is like, he has a lot of like sorrow and like things that he would love to tell you about over drinks about his life, but he's also snappy and quick with a comeback. And most importantly, great at stealing.
Yeah, but also like hyper aware of all the details happening in the room all at the same time. Like that timing and that ability to watch everything, but make it seem playful at the same time. That's why Gambit and Black Cat are both so fun, right? There's a complexity to them, even though they like bury it in like sex appeal.
Exactly. Yeah, he also is incredibly aware of his sex appeal and sexuality and sensuality and never afraid to make use of it, either for a job or for a good time, which I really appreciate. And I love that he loves a good time. He's not too serious.
The X-Men have been around, you know, 60 years. Gambit's been around a little over 30. He's one of the newer characters from Claremont. He's a great character. We're not going to get lost in his origins here, but it's complicated. Go see the Black Womb episode if you'd like more on all the crazy. He might be the missing Summers brother. We don't know exactly what's happening. But he was an orphaned child who was brought in by the New Orleans Thieves Guild. His real name is Remy LeBeau, and I'm not going to do French accents here. He's betrothed to a young woman named Belladonna Boudreau, who is eventually his wife. It's very much a Romeo and Juliet story, how they end up together, and it ends tragically. And Gambit ends up on the X-Men, where Rogue is the love of his life and his current wife. And every once in a while, we see Belladonna pop up. And, you know, there's always these kind of stories about Gambit's mysterious origins. Now, the Thieves Guild also has a long history at Marvel, but it's primarily associated with Gambit. They have their own island, but also there's a New York Thieves Guild with a woman named Odessa Drake who runs it. But also there's Odessa's a great character. But also there's a counter group called the Assassins Guild that they're always at war with. And it's just kind of complicated. And Belladonna is in the mix of it all. What do you think, Kandra is in the mix of it all. What do you think Kandra's motivations as an immortal blonde bimbo creating these crazy societies of thieves and assassins that are forever pitted against each other and vying for her attention and affection?
Well, so I've got two answers to this. One of them is more canon compliant, and the other one is kind of what my heart tells me.
Okay.
I mean, the canon compliant answer is that she is looking for these tributes because they either give her life force or just a sense of power. And also, of course, her connection to these guilds gives her access to people who she can kill because of her whole thing where she can draw on death to replenish her life force. Mm-hmm. That said, like, I think the reason she's gone about this way, I think she could have done this a lot of ways. So I think the reason she went about it this way is because of the drama. If you can set up two rival groups, this is like saying to the theater kids at a high school, you can have a musical, but you have to compete to show me which one it should be. Like, I think it's just feeding her toxic love of watching people fight.
You'd be bored as an immortal unless you had something to do, right? Look at how look at how Zeus toyed with everyone. Kendra has set herself up in a position of power. And her thing is, and we see her first, by the way, in the first Gambit limited series from 1993 by Howard Mackey. It's a fun read. It's a little dated. I don't know if you've read this one.
I did. I thought it was a hoot. I found the ending quite poignant.
Sure. Question mark? Let's talk about it. But we learn that Kendra is this immortal woman they call the Benefactress. Belladonna is the heir of the Assassin's Guild. Gambit is the heir of the Thieves Guild. Again, it's very Romeo and Juliet. And for hundreds of years, she has been kind of manipulating these guilds who have signed kind of like pacts of power for her. She receives a tithe from them very consistently based on whatever they are earning through their assassin contracts or their thievery. And if she's pleased with you, she'll give you something called the Elixir of Life, which will let you live longer. So several members of the Gambit's family have been around for decades longer than they would have otherwise, including Gambit's really hot dad.
I also would be struggling to kill that man if told that my option was that of the Elixir of Life.
But also she'll give you superpowers through this elixir sometimes. You almost get the vibe it's kind of like a drug that you have to replenish in order to keep the powers. There's a whole bunch of characters associated with these guilds that we're not going to talk about. From Gris to the Tithe Collector to Tantamata there's a bunch of these characters that are kind of associated with Gambit and Belladonna's history specifically.
It's given a little like John Wick, but with more humidity.
And more alcohol. Are you a Belladonna Boudreaux fan? I'm kind of into her.
Oh, I really like her. I love how inconsistent she is with her, what vibe she's bringing to the party.
She's named after poison.
Yeah, she's got this like very, in her flashback scenes, she's very cut off jeans. And then in her contemporary like energy, she's very sophisticated. And I don't know, she gives Gemini to me. She's like, which face are you going to get? You don't get to find out. You don't get to know.
I love how you, I adore more than love. I adore how you kind of apply a sense of whimsy to all of these evil people. You're like, they're just having fun. It's great. When we first meet Kendra, she's been fucking Gideon, which, maybe he's really...
The choice. Talented.
He has a nice body, but the hair alone is a reason to just not go there. This is not a man to be trusted. He's a terrible character. But she's kind of looking out at the city. She's bored with immortality. We start to get the vibe that she is this benefactress or this mysterious woman. Gambit seeks her out because he needs the Elixir of Life for Belladonna because she's dying. And I'm going to oversimplify that story. And Kendra comes out in Gambit number 3 wearing red panties, bare shoulders, bare stomach, but like also a cape and boots. She's Emma Frost, but in like red lingerie.
Here's the thing. If you've got those legs, it is your, I think, civic responsibility to have those stems on display. She looks great. Is it a misogynistic costume? Of course it is. Does she look banging? You know, like I can't hold her accountable for this or anything. She's a goddess of guile. She can wear a little sexist costume if she wants.
We also learned right from the beginning that she and Gambit have been fucking. You kind of get the idea that she's had a hand in his life. She's been watching him for a while.
Hand in his life and elsewhere.
I want to assume she waited till he turned 18, but she was waiting and like watching.
Watching, tapping her watch. Here's the thing that I love though. She is like so clear that he's a great way. She's like, this guy changed my life. Fantastic, phenomenal, nothing like it. Like she's giving him a glowing recommendation. She's like 5 stars. I love having that knowledge about Gambit. We all suspected.
She keeps her vial of elixir like in between her boobs. It's going to give you life if you can
Keeps you
find it.
cozy.
Let me give you one of her speeches toward Gambit, because she wants a favor if he wants the elixir. Please let me tell you about my guilds. Oh, yes, Remy, my guilds. I set them up centuries ago. I gave them the elixir and the powers. Thieves and assassins, always at my service as I reaped the benefits of both, using each to keep the other in check in a never-ending rivalry. But it is an old system, my love, one conceived in an earlier era when I was much younger. It's time to shake things up. I have a need for a new organization to help me toward future aspirations. Out with the old and in with the new, I always say. And I kind of just like she's just Joan Crawford for me the whole time is what I'm realizing.
Absolutely. Well, and also, I don't think that she has an idea of what she wants to do next when she starts this speech. I think it's that thing where you're like, I'm going to find it as I go. It's going to come to me. I'm going to figure it out. Because what she really wants, the favor that she wants from him, is pretty clearly just his body.
Yeah, but she orders him to kill his comatose dad, Jean-Luc.
What's more seductive than asking someone to kill their dad?
There's also, and we're just not going to get into it. Gambit also has a brother named Julian who is complicated. So Julian is there. He wants the elixir. He's choking out. I said it's Gambit's brother. I'm so sorry. This is Belladonna's brother. He's the heir to the Assassin's Guild, but Gambit, he's the who's the guy Romeo kills? He's the Mercutio in the story.
Tybalt?
Yes. When Juliet's brother or cousin dies, that's Mercutio,
Cousin,
right?
yeah.
Is
I
it
thought it's.
Tybalt? It's
You know
all. It's
what?
been a minute.
Yeah, it's been a minute. We're doing fine.
But he died, and then Candor brought him back to life as an assassin to go after Gambit, basically. So continuity. We're just mixing it all together. So Julian's choking Kandra and Gambit saves her and then Jean-Luc gets stabbed and then Kandra slams Julian out the window to avoid like staining her Persian carpets and then Gambit kisses her so hard and takes his dad and gets the fuck out of there and Kandra's like everything is mine now but here's a direct quote she goes oh an end to the boredom that comes with long life but then she realizes he pickpocketed her boobs and took the vial and now she's mad and she wants to murder everybody. There's a quick summary of Gambit number three.
Okay, so here is the one point of beef I have with this fight. I do actually love the line about, basically intervening in a way that really helps Gambit and saying, I didn't want to get blood on my Persian carpets. I think that she's covering very much for like some affection for Gambit and being like, no, I'm just vain. But my beef with this fight is that as someone who is possessed of an ample bosom myself, I'm very familiar with the storage capacity of said chest area. And if I want to get something out of my bra, I have to stick like my entire forearm in there. It is not a quick lift. It's not easy. These things have got staying power. They have grip. They have hidden portals to other dimensions, which mostly contain popcorn and like pretzel crumbs. But there's just no way with the size of what Kandra is carrying. There's no way that you can do a quick pickpocket without her noticing.
You're assuming she's wearing a bra.
That's fair. Maybe it's just a levitation. Maybe when you're an external, you have some anti-gravity.
It's always been kind of supposed that Gambit has a slightly like hypnotic like he makes you want him kind of vibe.
I mean,
Maybe his kiss was just that good, or maybe she was okay with the vial being stolen, and she just wants an adventure.
maybe she felt the rummage, but she was just like, man, he's really got some new moves since the last time we were together.
So there's a big attack in New Orleans. Oversummarizing this, the Thieves Guild and the Assassins Guild both end up turning against her. They're like, "Fuck you, we're gonna do it by ourselves from now on." And she loses her position of power. She gives this big speech about how it's going to be a new time and a new organization. And, good for you, girl. Like, move on. We also just kind of see her, even though I like this ending for her. I like that she started high and then ended low, and it makes you want more. I also looked up, by the way, Candra is an old Sanskrit name that means of the moon or glowing, which is an interesting interpretation, too.
Beautiful.
Give me your 1-2 punch on the Gambit Limited series. Was this a good introduction for this character?
I thought so. absolute blast reading it. And I think that it, again, it brings the camp, it brings the drama. She does get laid low in a way that really has me as a reader being like, oh, but you know she's going to come back for vengeance. And also she looks phenomenal, which I think is like her main concern.
We get a very brief appearance in X-Men Annual number 3, where she's now looking for a new base of power and is trying it with the Hellfire Club. I kind of like this idea of the exposed immortal mutant recognizing times are changing for mutants, and now she's trying to get involved. Shinobi Shaw's here. There's a couple like members that you've never heard of, and the mission doesn't really end well. But the key piece is Kandra's costume in this. It's heels, suit coat, naked underneath. Like, that's her look.
You know what? Like, it's a classic. It's timeless. It's elegant. Practical. Endlessly practical. Because what more do you need than a suit coat and heels? She's ready for anything.
Any thoughts on Kandra in the Hellfire Club?
You know, again, I will just say I think that her primary concern here is how she looks. And I think she has done a great job paying attention to that.
She's got to be in that room being like, ooh, Celine was here. Plus, there's that Emma Frost chick. I'm not sure this is the right place for me.
Yeah, just a little threat.
Also, Shinobi Shaw's so gay, and she needs men who want her around. We then jump to X-Men Unlimited number 7. Now, this is a story we're going to be reading a script of on my show this summer, which will be a good time. We're doing the X-Men Unlimited scripts for some reason, but it's a great time.
Fun.
This is a story where she's, again, looking for power. Do you want to talk about her entrance look here with her puffer jacket? Oh, she's fabulous. So she's got like a designer puffer jacket look with like a concentric cape and like skin tight black bodysuit and like puffer jacket boots up to her thighs.
The puffer jacket boots are what I want to talk about. I have been in my, I've been traveling for the last 9 weeks or so, and I have been in colder climates than I've ever encountered in my life. And I've been learning the art of layering, of good boots with double layers of socks. And when do you wear the puffy coat? When do you wear the sweater? When do you need a hat? When do you need gloves? And I think my hosts in these cold climates have been letting me down. And frankly, leaving me in a dangerously exposed situation by not teaching me about the thigh-high puffy boots.
Maybe they were custom-made?
They have to be. Where? I'm sorry, does Payless have a thigh-high puffy boot section that I didn't know about? This is an iconic look. It has got to be so sweaty inside those boots.
Yeah. Maybe she doesn't sweat. Maybe she holds it off telekinetically.
Well, maybe all that moisture goes into her hair to keep it hydrated. So
maybe her
the volume.
Sweat. Maybe her sweat is the elixir of life itself. We just don't.
Oh. Okay. Well, that's
that one was too far.
I'm gonna be thinking about that one for a while.
Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Okay, so I'm going to summarize this one quickly. It's about a lot of things. It's about Storm, and it's about Storm's years in Cairo under the thief master Ahmed Al-Jabbar. Storm is also a thief. She grew up after being orphaned as a thief in Cairo. Kandra has a new assassin working for her. His name is Bond. And she likes to torture him a little bit, and he's just a big, super strong guy. And she has registered a new mutant power in someone named Jamil, J-A-M-I-L. She wants to play the long game and, like, take over someone else's base. So if she has this new mutant she can control, it will allow her to have this base. So she's basically trying to set up a new base of operations in Cairo once Ahmed El-Jabbar dies. But Storm and Jean Grey and Gambit are there. Jamil is a odd character who has a friend named Karima who has no powers. Please remember that in a minute, Jamil and Karima. Storm challenges Kandra to single combat, which is very like Storm in the Morlock Tunnels moment. She lashes out with a sandstorm, and Kandra's like, "I'm impressed, Storm. With powers such as these, there is no wonder you were once worshipped as a goddess. But sadly, even the power of a goddess is not enough to fell an external." So she's been hiding behind the scenes for a long time. This is her first like real moment of like flexing, and doesn't end very well. Do you want to talk about this battle between Kandra and Storm?
I just think that, I mean, first of all, both of them have such a flair for dramatic visuals that I think single combat is the only way for the two of them to face off, because anyone else is going to get lost in the swirling hair and the like face journeys that they want to take you on. I think it's a little tragic for Kandra to be like, "I'm coming out of retirement, baby. It's my comeback. And for my first fight in the ring, I'm taking on Storm." Like, girl, you got to start smaller, build up some hype, get yourself back in the game.
It is a big old planet out there. She just wants a base of power, poor thing. She tries to kill everybody and in the end just retreats with Bond, and Jamil chooses to follow her. Now, again, remember Jamil for just a minute from now. The other key piece of this issue is when Gambit opens up about his past with Kandra, how like they had like lots of hot fucking great sex, but then he's like, she's selfish and he left her and betrayed her. Like that's basically the origin story. Did Gambit turn her into a supervillain, or was she always this way?
I mean, him being like, "She's selfish," I'm like, say more. Anytime that any man who I've ever met is like complaining to me about his feminine ex, I'm like, give me the details. Oh, she's so crazy, huh? Explain exactly how. I want to know what Gambit did, and I want to know what Kandra said that made him go, "You're too selfish for me. I have to leave."
Kandra, I mean, she's evil, obviously, but we support women's wrongs and we love evil here. And she
Absolutely,
hasn't
yeah.
really done anything that horrible yet. She's just kind of, she's trying to mess with people. It's fine.
Yeah, she just states her intentions. She's like, "I want you to be dead." And you know what? A feeling is not a crime.
In the Rogue Limited series, which is shortly after this, Kandra gets a bunch of stuff to do right in a row as this ancillary X-Men villain. We're at the funeral for Marius Boudreau. Belladonna is recruited by Kandra. They end up kind of working together. She's back in her puffer jacket armor. She wants her Assassin's Guild back. She tells Belladonna, like, "I knew your dad. I knew your grandpa. Like, maybe we can work together again." And she wants Belladonna, if she wants back in, you got to bring me Gambit. She goes, "After all this nasty business is over, perhaps we can go back to conducting business as usual. Once more, I can be the benefactress to the assassins." So she wants Gambit, and she's like sending Gambit's ex-wife after him. She loves drama, you told me right at the beginning.
What a mess! What a mess! She loves creating disastrous interpersonal situations. I mean, I also, though, I feel for her because she's constantly pitching everybody. She's like, "Okay, who's gonna help me out? Who's gonna be working with me here? I gave you guys the elixir of life. I gave you my gym towel runoff. Like, who's gonna bring me the drama that I so richly deserve?"
And she's doing it in the most dramatic way because she could just go after. So she ends up creating a whole bunch of assassins and giving them powers. Like, again, we don't know exactly how she does this. She has some sort of magic something or like a potion, like mutant growth hormone or something. And Rogue is fighting through all these assassins because Rogue's the one that's getting involved here. Of course, Remy's there too. There's a moment where Belladonna's like, "Why are you making us fight?" And she goes, "I do it for the same reason I do everything, because I can," which is maybe her best line ever.
Oh, honestly, I really am getting Joan. Like, she is vamping nonstop, and this is some delicious, like, very golden age of a Hollywood dialogue that we're getting. because I can.
She captures Gambit as well as Tantamate and Cody Robbins, who's in a coma. This is the boy Rogue kissed when she was a kid. She strings Gambit upside down. I would have loved you forever if you hadn't betrayed me. We're skipping over a bunch of shit here. But in the end, Kandra makes Rogue choose between like having her powers or saving Cody. Rogue wins the fight and Cody dies in the end. And that's kind of where it winds up. It's her big drama moment. Cody, she didn't kill Cody. He just died as a result of the battle, you know?
I gotta tell you, Rogue really gets the shit kicked out of her in all of the Kandra reading that I did for this. I mean, we really get the kind of highlight reel of her tragic life. And I'm just like, girl, you need a break. She needs some time off.
Rogue is my favorite. Heart of gold, amazing leader, not a lick of common sense. Like, I adore her so much. I can't wait to get to her on my show when we get there. I'm taking my sweet time, but I love her very much. One of my all-time, like, top three favorite X-Men is Rogue.
Oh, yeah.
Jamil, meanwhile, has appeared in Wolverine 94 and 99. As a guide to the Dark Riders, Cyber and Wolverine to a base of Apocalypse, and he's working for Kandra here. And he got like aged up and he got pretty hot. He's like given like Aladdin in the desert vibes, looking real good. Then things get weird for the Eternals. Remember the Jamil thing. We'll get back there in a second. Nicodemus and Burke both died of the Legacy Virus. Then Selene drained the life of Saul, Gideon, Absalom, and Cruel, because when she kills them, she gets all their power and they're still going to come back anyway, right? So it's like a big power boost for Selene, who's like binging on, you know, external life force. It's fine. And around the same time, Marvel gets the legal rights to the company publishing the comics in the Ultraverse. And there's a series called Nightman Gambit where Selene is there and there's a big fight and Kandra shows up. It truly just is entirely inconsequential, but for the completists out there, that gets us through some weird Marvel history. I don't know if you have any comments on this section. We're just gonna like skirt right past it.
No, we can keep moving.
There's a lot of books being published and a lot of stories being told at this time. And then we get maybe my favorite Kandra story, which is X-Men Volume 2, numbers 60 and 61. Kandra in this one takes over the mind of Cyclops and demands that Storm give the Heart of Eternal Darkness back. So in a flashback, we see how Storm as a child stole a powerful gem. And as she fled, the house that it had been in was destroyed by an energy blast by all who lived there. And Storm later learned that this stone she stole as a kid, this heart, was a source of enormous power. This is Kandra's life force. It's a great little nugget to add to this character. So Kandra meets Storm in the present at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. She's keeping Karima captive. That's the little girl from the X-Men Unlimited story. And she has Jamil there with her. And it turns out that Kandra learned years ago that the Externals could be killed with a blade to the heart. So she transferred her energy into this stone. We talked about this a little bit earlier. And that's the one that Storm has stolen. Kandra's been looking for it for like fucking decades, apparently. Like, no, she doesn't know where her life force is, which is hilarious. You know, like, watch your shit, man. Put it in a safe. So we learned that Jamil turns out to be a construct of the Shadow King. And the Shadow King, who's like basically the astral devil, then steals the energies from the heart. But also it turns out Jamil was never the mutant. It was Karima. And she can create constructs of the desires of other people. And she had created Jamil for Ahmed El-Jabbar to distract Kandra from the heart. And then the heart was destroyed and Kandra ran away. This is like a crazy little story, but it just puts Kandra, the reason I said it's my favorite, it puts Kandra into the X-Men universe in like a very clear way. We connect her to Storm. We connect her to the Shadow King. And then this heart story is the one that keeps coming back up in the modern stories. This like transfer your essence into a stone story. Any thoughts on this one? It's a pretty fun read and the art is gorgeous.
I mean, my big thought is that transfer your essence into a stone story is the one that really, to me, stands out as like being a thread that connects a lot of different Kandra stories, even when Kandra isn't directly on the page. Like, if I feel like if we're storing our life force in a stone, I'm going to be looking for Kandra later.
Chandra also references a time when another mortal got control of her heart and manipulated her, and it's something she's vowed never to happen again, but then Storm had it for like 20 years or something.
I mean, listen, I also love vowing that I'm never going to let things happen again in relationships, and then they do. Who are we to judge?
Chandra, if we're reading, she's guile, but she's not necessarily, and tell me if you disagree, she's not necessarily a lot of intelligence. She's focused on the plot in front of her, but she just kind of, she has this like flaw of just expecting that everyone's going to do as she says. And she always seems a little surprised when they don't. Like, look how gorgeous I am. Look how powerful I am. You should love me. And she's always like rage whenever that goes wrong. It's like she's trying to, she just keeps like caper after caper, like hitting ground zero all over again, you know?
I mean, here's the thing. As someone who works in a creative industry and who actually kind of, like, I sort of work in one creative industry, but I sort of work in like three creative industries, just because of the way that different types of writing fall into different categories. And I have met this person in every creative industry I've ever touched, is the person who thinks they're playing four-dimensional chess with other people's emotions and needs, who's like, oh, I'm a master manipulator. And everyone around them is just like, oh, what the fuck are they doing? What's their problem? And you end up with like, you know, those conversations where you're like, oh, this person said this thing to me about you. Oh, well, that's not true. And you know that that person is over thinking that they've made these like huge machinations. And that's what I think Chandra is doing. She's like, oh, none of them will see me coming. And everyone's like, hey, Chandra, is that you?
In the 90s, Fabian Nicieza did a Gambit series that lasted 25 issues. It's time travel, it's alternate realities, it's dream visions, it's crazy huge characters popping in and out, round and round, new characters popping in and out. Sinister gets shit here. Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff packed into the series, and every issue is a long read. And I've read it a couple times recently because we did episodes on characters from there, including Fontenelle and Black Womb, both of whom are characters you would adore, Sarah, actually. So Chandra gets a bunch of stuff in this series. There's a bunch of flashbacks that aren't given a lot of context. In one, we see Gambit, who's 15, and he meets Chandra, but she's already met an adult version of him, and she's already known his dad her entire life. We don't quite know exactly what's going on. We see her dealing with a mutant slaver named the Pig in the present. We get a flashback to World War II, where she's helping Nazi Baron Heinrich Zemo, like, assemble power.
Not ideal.
We flash back to 1891, where she's manipulating the thieves in the Assassin's Guild into stealing an artifact called the Momentary Princess. She's torturing little Jean-Luc Lebeau and Belize Marceau. She's got them chained up. She's got a writing crop.
She loves chaining some people up.
I don't know if you saw. I don't know if you saw this look. She's in a lined purple suit, divided belt, with like a floor-length skirt, but like slit up to her hips, and her boobs are basically out in like a lacy front, and she's like whipping children that she's hung from her wall.
Okay, so the whipping children part, not iconic, but the rest of the look, I love how she's like, I'm wearing so much, but I am wearing nothing at all. I think that
fashion
is a feat. Yes, it is giving fashion.
So there's a connection between her and Apocalypse mentioned here. He's in a hibernation chamber. Gambit from the future shows up. One of the things he says to her is, the thing I like best about you, Chandra, is your consistency. You always got to do things the hard way, which is a fun read from him. She's now very focused on like self-power after this is kind of the key. She shows back up in Gambit 14. It's still 1891. She's still so slutty. Red one piece with like a cutaway to the center of her boobs that goes all the way down to her navel, plus knee-high heeled boots.
This woman is not letting her shins see daylight.
Gloves
up
to her armpits.
They are the one thing she's insecure about.
Flared cape, tiara. She...
I love that her tiara kind of is it has a little Magneto flair to it.
She also calls herself, there's a bid for power. Ozymandias shows up here, who's Apocalypse's weird little rock servant. We're just not going to go there. And she calls herself in this Chandra of the Floating Spires, which is very Lord of the Rings somehow. Maybe the Floating Spires are her breasts. We don't know.
You know, it's a little middle school, like, my name is Scorpion now. And everyone's like, all right, sure. Sure thing, Scorpion. You know, like, we're going to affirm, but don't think this is going to last.
She also uses magic in this appearance, which shows us that's probably where the elixir of life stuff and like the granting of superpowers comes from. But it's just not widely explored with this character. And this is where she connects with the externals, like, really heavy for the first time. Mr. Sinister's here. She gets, like, humbled and, like, dumped back to the Eternals for, like, recompense. And that's
kind
of all
we get.
Okay, this
is the thing. Marvel, if you're listening, I want to write a Kandra arc where she doesn't get humbled. Because she gets humbled over and over again. And then she builds herself back up. And she, like, gets herself a steam in gear. And she puts her little playlist on that I think probably has a lot of, like, Lizzo on it. And she goes out into the world and she's like, this is my time to shine. This is Kandra's day. And then she gets humbled again immediately. Our girl needs a win.
I always ask at the end. So let's start thinking about this. What's the Kandra story you want? And it could be that you want to write, or you could choose not to say anything because you want to save your ideas. But I've got some really fun Kandra ideas. She's camp and chaos in a great way. I think she's delightful. I'm going to cover a bunch of shit really fast. Cable 150 through 154, there's a huge external story where Gideon murders Kandra to get her power. Again, she's very dead. You can only be killed by another external, basically. Scarlet Spider, volume 2, number 19. You would not
what expect a tone shift. Oh my God. In my reading for this episode, I was like in the headspace of a certain tone with like a lot of more classic X-Men. And I got to Scarlet Spider and it was like, whoa.
Scarlet Spider is about the clone of Peter Parker. The tagline is all the power, none of the responsibility. And it's him in like Dallas. I think he's in Dallas or Houston. Like just trying to live his life, and he keeps getting sucked back into shit. And the Thieves Guild is here. It's a pretty good time. Or the Assassin's Guild, excuse me. There's a huge hit. They order him to kill Wolverine. Kandra's there. She has another new alias here. She calls herself the Red Death. Which is
fantastic.
Oof, I prefer Kandra of the Floating Spires to the Red.
It's giving menstruation and I respect it.
No.
I really loved her look in this one though. She looks like when the cat has like pulled all the toilet paper off the roll and then you try and put the toilet paper back on. And it doesn't go on in like a tidy way. It's kind of like weird and wobbly. And she's got this like scarf cape that's sort of just wound around her. And it's like, at first I was like, that doesn't make any sense. She wouldn't be able to move. And then I was like, well, she's an external. She can do whatever she wants.
But she's also like a zombie woman in this. She's like came back from the dead wrong and like needs some help. And now she's like wanting to drain everyone's life. It doesn't end up going well. She gets scared of a spider. She gets her mouth webbed shut. She gets stabbed by Wolverine's claws. She has to drain her own followers' lives to stay alive. And at the end, Kane kills her with a stinger to the head. And of course she's going to come back, but this is like the undead zombie woman who then tries to get power in the horror movie. And they like close her in the coffin at the end of it. It's a pretty, I don't know. This is a pretty fun issue, actually. It's a pretty good series.
I thought it was a hoot and I thought it was super fun. I didn't love that she got defeated by being scared by a spider. It felt a little disrespectful, but also it was so funny and fun to read that I'm not mad about it.
We jump to Mr. and Mrs. X 11 and 12. I love this series. This is the Rogue and Gambit like romp. This is where Xandra shows up. There's a lot of really great X-Men moments in this series and so many characters.
Oh, I just found it. I found it to be so much fun and such a different creative direction. Again, this was like very breath of fresh air for me. Really entering a very humorous and not too self-serious tone for the X-Men. And I don't know, I really enjoyed the way that they played with genre.
Kandra looks like JonBenet Ramsey now. She has come back as a little like supermodel child, and she wants the Thieves and Assassins Guilds back. Tell me about baby Kandra.
Child Kandra looks so much like the platonic Kandra that lives in my mind, but smaller and very occasionally childlike, and then very occasionally for grown up. I'm fascinated by the reasoning for her being in the body of a child, that it's like the best she can do right now, but she's ready to be out of that body and back to her full adult sex pot glamour like situation that she's used to.
Do you have you seen The Emperor's New Groove?
Yes.
This is very Yzma being trapped in the little cat body. I'm a cat now.
You know what? First of all, yes. And second of all, I do think that there's some Eartha Kitt in her dialogue generally.
I love Eartha Kitt. One of my all-time favorite celebrities
of course.
Ever. She's amazing. So baby Kandra wants her power back. She captures Rogue and Belladonna, and she gets Gambit, and she's like, I'll kill one of them. You can choose who lives. But of course, she gets defeated. He's the king of the thieves. And at the end, Belladonna pulls her away and is like, don't make me mad or I'll send you to middle school. She's like, ah, you know?
It's a very funny, like, Scooby-Doo villain ending where it's like, oh, now I've got your hands held behind your back and there's nothing you can do, you're powerless now. And I'm like, I don't know, she is still an external, like, she has quite a lot of powers, but not if her hands are behind her back.
There's a bunch more Thieves Guild stuff. Kandra gets mentioned once in a while, but this is basically it for Kandra until the Krakoan era, where Teenie Howard has her Excalibur run, which is all about mutant magic. It's mutants using their powers in magical ways. It's Otherworld. It's Avalon. Apocalypse is here. She gives us an entirely different origin story and makes him this magic like Lord who is like it's pretty fantastic. The Excalibur run front to back, when you combine it with Knights of X and Captain Britain, it's a good strong solid chunk of X-Men history. I don't know if you're a Teenie Howard fan. I adore her work on this series. I think it's wonderful.
She's fantastic. I actually had the opportunity to meet her at the last San Diego Comic-Con, and she's lovely and very kind, and of course a brilliant writer.
One of my dear friends, Philip Seavey, who's a real friend of mine here, he calls Teenie his best friend. And I'm like, introduce me. I'm a huge fan. So the externals are back. Apocalypse wants to use the externals' magic. Like, okay, I'm going to read this little speech because I think it will clarify something that I won't explain otherwise. Apocalypse calls the externals his coven. It's a magic circuit of externals, and he's like been involved with them for centuries, although we've literally barely seen him interact with them. Long have I believed that mutant kind seeks one another by nature. More than wanting to live among one another, we are intended to for our own protection. The High Lords of us understood that. We prefer to be called High Lords over externals. When we desire to meet, it takes little more than a thought to bring us together. For that reason, we almost never call upon one another. We are connected in other ways as well. Our energies are like that of a single organism. If one of us dies, the others feel ourselves become stronger, as though one had distributed the contents of them among us. So when one of our number had a plan to extract her own life energy, Kandra, and place it into a stone, it was in my own interest to help. The creation of the infamous gem that once held her life force was, in many ways, my first ritual. It was power we could all have shared, but she chose to remove it from herself and keep it rather than share it among her kindred. When I sunk the blade into her heart, I could have taken it for myself. Some of us felt like it was theft to keep a shared thing like that in a stone, where she could hide it away from us. But the power contained within was a temptation for impatient men, lesser men. Individual power comes and goes. But I now knew the ritual of the coven, the mastery over power that our kind has always been destined for, the gift of rebirth. And then in the next issue, we see the externals have granted their own, like, volcanic crater on Krakoa, and Apocalypse has summoned them, and they have to come if they're summoned. Gideon and Absalon are here, like the whole group, and they Kandra is like, I heard you played at being a sorcerer, but I didn't know you were speaking in riddles. Celine and Kandra are meeting kind of for the first time. Basically, what's happening here is Apocalypse is seeking to trick this group into sacrificing their lives so he can complete a spell that will open a gate of power into Otherworld. And he has his own motivations. And at the end of this, all of the externals, but like a couple, die, and they are turned into a gate that later Celine animates into like a giant crazy like monster to attack everyone, an immortal X-Men. But it doesn't exactly work because Gambit stole Kandra's gem again. And her spirit is like taunting him for a while. And he's like, I'll help her. But so I'm kind of summing up this really incredible storyline. Richter's involved. There's a bunch of like intrigue. Kandra gets outguiled by Apocalypse, which has to be embarrassing.
Mortifying.
And I'm kind of summing all that up in a few sentences, but tell me your thoughts on this Excalibur run. And I mean, Tini's work with the externals here is phenomenal.
Oh, incredibly detailed. And I really love the way that we get a sense of individual identity, as you mentioned, like getting everybody being their own person and not sort of just a nebulous part of a group. It's fascinating. And frankly, the like, again, the sibling energy is there. The like, this was my first ritual, was doing this thing to help you. The thing that was kind of selfish, but also maybe I'm kind of selfish. I think is very, it's brilliant storytelling. It's incredibly well constructed. And also, I just love any big ritual that's taking place on a volcano. I just, it's iconic.
We do get one line of dialogue where Kandra mentions that she has avoided narrowly being burned at a few stakes over the years. Again, reference to her long history. Her stone matters here in big ways. But she didn't die because she is back in Marvel Voices Pride, Volume 3, Number 1, in the story Be Gay, Do Crime by Sarah Gailey. we talked a little earlier about your use of this character and how you found her. This is a delightful story. We see like a giant statue of Kandra has been built by her followers, representing her eternal life. Her gem is glistening in the statue's hand, and Black Cat commits a heist and runs through the gem to where Kandra is like hiding in a dimension inside the gem.
Just chilling.
She's just hanging out on her throne.
Yeah, this is her like snuggie and TikTok time.
She still has a little bit of like her little girl vibe here. Like she's like a little bit younger, a little bit adolescent in this appearance. Is that how you interpreted it as well?
I think that she's young and vital. I would definitely not say childlike or adolescent in the writing, but as I said, the outfit that she's wearing is the platonic ideal Kandra outfit to me, and it happens to be quite similar to her outfit that she wore when she was in her
maybe that's why body. The recognition was there for me, but I assumed she was of age, of course. But she does have a very young
matters to externals too.
We have to read this interchange between Kandra and Black Cat. If I read Kandra, will you read Black Cat in this interchange?
I would love to.
So Black Cat has stolen her way into this place, and Kandra says on her throne, I know you're kind, selfish, predictable. You always want the same things. What will it be then? Riches beyond the wildest limits of your tiny, fragile imagination?
I can get those any old time.
Eternal life?
Ugh, been there, nothing.
Your loved ones returned from beyond the veil.
I think we still need a little space, to be honest.
Then it can only be one thing, and my answer is no. You've come to try to get me to take the New York Thieves Guild back into my good graces. I will not.
That's not why I'm here. Good one, though.
Kandra shrinks from giant back to mortal size and says, I do not often experience confusion. And I'm not sure I believe that.
You know she believes it. I'm not here for any of that. I'm here for you.
Yes, for an audience with me.
Not quite an audience. I was thinking something more like a date.
What?
You, me. Sorry. You know. Me, you. Dinner and whatever.
But aren't you in love with...
Just for fun. No strings attached.
I don't see what this would gain you. I wouldn't grant additional favors aside from my company.
Oh, I can think of some favors we could grant each other, but no pressure, really. The company of a beautiful goddess who loves theft is all I ask. Whatever you're into, I promise I'm good at it. So what do you say?
And we never see her answer. Did Kendra and Felicia fuck?
Well, I will say that in the last beautiful big splash page of this story, we see that Felicia is twirling an opera length red glove with one hand, and so you have to assume that she at least got one piece of clothing off of our costumed goddess.
God, it's delicious. It's so horny, and I love it. This this banter is delightful. What's it like to revisit this after talking about Kendra's insane history?
So much fun. I mean, again, like, our girl needs a win, and I think that getting flirted with by a very hot thief might be a little bit of a win. I also just, I have so much affection for her mess and calamity that she is.
So we've seen Kendra as the benefactress. We've seen Kendra as the external extra. We've seen Kendra as the undead, like, witch woman trying to drain life force to come back. We've seen her trying to seize and control power, but nothing that's ever made her a very credible threat. Not in the way Celine and Apocalypse have, but I do think she has the potential. Or do we have a completely different story in mind for her? What's the Kendra story you would love to see, Sarah Gailey?
Oh, I have two thoughts. I mean, I do think that in some ways she gets the scrappy-do treatment a little bit. she's kind of like not to be taken too seriously, takes herself way too seriously. So I would love to either see, again, her getting a low-key win, just maybe deciding to have a day out on the town with her girlfriend, Felicia, and getting to knock over a bank and experiencing the thrill of just one job well done. Or an arc where she really does try and at least for a little bit succeed in coming to her own power as a real, as you said, threat, a real credible threat as someone who has been overlooked and shouldn't have been.
If I were to write a Kendra story, I would love like a limited series. God, I would love to write for Marvel. I'm writing all the time. There is a team of villains. She is the person behind the scenes, but she's still featured prominently. She's assembled a group of kind of ragtag characters, given them a purpose, sent them to commit a heist. And at the end, of course, she betrays all of them and is left in like a very high position of power with all of them suffering, which is then setting her up for a future storyline. Oversimplification, but I think the mastery of kind of her flirtation, her giving some insight. I would love a story into her background a little bit so that we kind of see where she came from and why she is the way she is. But I would love to see her come out on top for once rather than the gorgeous witch that just keeps getting knocked down and violently murdered and drained, you know? It's a different type of story.
Justice for Kendra.
There's very little exploration given to her magic side, or frankly, even her telekinesis. We don't see her using her powers much. She's much more the influencer, but she's just really bad at it. My favorite thing is the fashion more than anything. I love her for that more than anything else, in an Emma Frost kind of way, right?
Yeah, she's a little bit the Regina George of the externals. Great at turning looks and influencing people until all of a sudden she's not.
Does she have genuine feelings of affection for Gambit, or is he just a great guy?
I think so. I think that she has, because I think that that line about the Persian rugs is such a blatant misdirection. And, you know, listen, if he's a great enough lay, that can turn into genuine affection. There are some people who just have skill that creates emotion in anyone who experiences it.
She has a wealth of potential. I'm enormously fond of this character. I love Celine, and I am fond of Apocalypse, but Kendra is fantastic, man. I would also love to see like a Kendra Celine kind of like sister like villain one-off. They would be the worst. They hate each other. You know they hate each other. Kendra's much younger than Celine, but Celine still looks hot. There'd be lots of age jokes. It's like Real Housewives energy between them. The drama alone. God, that would be fun to write too.
and I would love to see the dynamic, which is one of my favorites, which is nobody gets to hurt my little sister but me. You know, just a little bit of like, I don't like you and I don't respect you, but I'm not going to let somebody else fuck with you if it'll take away my opportunity to fuck with you.
Kendra is a self-involved, gorgeous narcissist who loves power and loves trickery and loves drama. And what is not to love about that kind of supervillain? What a fun, great character. She's very, very rarely been written by the same writer twice, but she has enough staying power that people like using her again and again. Interesting. This has been a fun conversation. It's made me feel lots of feelings.
So much fun. Thank you for inviting me to talk about her. She's sublime, and I'm just thrilled to get to celebrate her.
Thank you for coming on to talk. We're going to put this out on February 7th on the Patreon. Everybody should be checking out Know Your Station. They should be checking out White Widow. Is there anything else you are allowed to talk about, or what are you currently working on?
Nothing that I'm allowed to discuss. So I will just say that White Widow issue 4, I believe, will be on shelves the week that this comes out.
Yeah, so, in early February. I looked at that too.
Yeah, so I hope that your listeners will check it out. That'll be the end of the 4-issue mini that is giving White Widow her own space and her own story, and I hope that you all read it.
White Widow has gotten through her Cheesecake Assassin years and is now being given a real Florence Pugh energy in the best way by just a delicious, wonderful writer. Sarah Gailey, I'm a huge fan. I'm so pleased to have had the gift of your time today. Thank you for hanging out with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
On the main show, we're shifting gears right after this as we wrap up Amazing Adventures. We're jumping to another early 70s anthology title. This one's called Astonishing Tales Number 1. We get to read a very horny battle between Kraven the Hunter and Kazar. It's delicious. My guest on that episode is the incredible writer Rob Kirby, so everybody check that out. We'll see you back here next time. Thanks again, Sarah.